So the title of my little sermon today is It's a Family Affair. Someone once commented on the definition of a dysfunctional family with the following words. A dysfunctional family is any family comprised of two or more members. That's a catchy phrase, but before we parse the word dysfunctional, I think we might be better served by defining the word family. That's not as simple as it might sound. Sure, a blood relationship, mama, papa, brother, sister, maybe that's the initial thought in attempting to define family. But I think it's way too simple an answer. After all, what about legal definitions? I am related to my wife, Diane, by law and custom, not blood. Isn't she family? My oldest son, Steve, was adopted. Diane's parents, her sister, and her brother certainly are family. And on it goes. I'm an uncle. I'm a brother-in-law. I'm a grandpa. I was a nephew. I was a kid brother. So now we've added the legal entities to the equation. Is that it? If it were that simple, we could go right to the postlude music and have an early coffee hour. My premise, however, is that it is not that simple. When Diane and I first came to Castro Valley, we did not know a single soul. The location made sense due to work proximity, but for all practical purposes, friends and certainly family were elsewhere. We really weren't certain why we decided to settle in a town named after a Cuban political leader anyway, Castro Valley. That should give you an idea about our enlightened sense of California history. In early 2001, we stumbled upon this church. It was just after the election of George W. Bush to the presidency, and we felt it was time to find a spiritual retreat. I never thought it was possible that I could come to miss W. Lately, I find myself looking back upon his years as the good old days. Well, sort of. Anyway, that's a subject for another day. Again, neither of us being schooled in California history, we were equally clueless as to the namesake of this church, Thomas Starr King. Starr King seemed to us non-native Californians a fictional superhero, comic book character, Starr King, masked space traveler, come to save democracy. So what does all this have to do with family definitions? Gradually, this church became as much of a family, and sometimes more, as many of our blood relatives and our in-laws. The acceptance from and for this diverse group of people widened the conception of family for us. This Starr King congregation, by any definition I can think of, fulfills that role of family. But it does not diminish the more traditional definitions. Rather, it enhances them. Suddenly, my family is comprised of over 100 people, and all are family. Some closer than others, but still all family. And it certainly doesn't belie that cynical suggestion that all families are dysfunctional. Not by long shot. In an organization with a tenet of deeds, not creeds, isn't it inevitable, a certainty, that disagreements and dysfunction will follow? I think that while there might be turmoil and personality clashes at each and every step, I don't believe this means a permanent state of dysfunction. Disagreements, yeah. Dysfunction, no. Somehow, along the way from disagreements and clashes of wills, it seems we do manage to agree on ultimate goals and either avoid or evade dysfunction. If this weren't true, most of us likely would not be here today. And looking back to my own life's journey, it began to dawn on me that through life I had become part of many families, public schools, baseball teams, living at close quarters with every conceivable ethnic group as a member of the U.S. Navy, college, the various work environments. I believe all of those were, in some sense, family. All were interdependent communities, a place where the individual was both responsible for and reliant upon the other members of the family. And that's not to say that memories of every moment or of every family member were filled with only love and humanity, but they weren't filled with just anguish and anger either. Family seemed to engender both ends of that spectrum. I think that as individuals, we need to continue to evolve, and that every situation and every contact with others to which we are exposed is constantly and inevitably forging and hopefully broadening who we are and to what families we belong. And a necessary part of that is to embrace not only ourselves as individuals, but as members of a much larger interdependent group. At the gym where I work out, the family members represent every ethnic group on earth. And when some of the African Americans there refer to me as my brother, just recognizing our common humanity expands both theirs and my conception of family. The Eden Area Interfaith Group has introduced me to the communality of all religions practiced on this planet. When I attended a Ramadan feast at an Islamic mosque, I was at home, surrounded by and treated as family. Members of whom I might once have considered as totally alien or even as blood enemies. I have been fortunate enough to have traveled to many parts of the world. I cannot honestly tell you that I fell in love with every place I've seen. But while I came to realize that conditions vary and many conveniences we Americans take for granted either don't exist or are considered luxuries in many areas, but I've met people in all of those places. And while their lack of access to modern conveniences, diet, clothing, religions might be foreign to me, their humanity is not foreign to me. Of course, I'm broadening the definition of the word family, and I'm doing so with conscious intent. I'm also realizing that on an unconscious level, I've been doing this for my entire life. And I'm finding a great sense of satisfaction and, well, belonging in the process. And while my definition may not and probably is not yours, I have derived a sense of peace from this broadened sense of family. No one can be all things to all people. My traditional family certainly was important. But had my sense of family stopped there, I think most of what the world has offered to me would have stopped as well. In the public schools, I found adults who had many slants on life far different than those of my parents. As I questioned some of the diverse values I was hearing expressed, I realized what I had heard about the world and my existence in it was far more complicated than just being a son and a kid brother. Not every kid in my parents' economic class ate the same food, as did my family. Not all had voted for the same presidential candidate as my mom and dad. And growing up in a sort of lower middle class blue collar area, mostly composed of families only recently arrived from places in Europe, there were only two religions in my immediate neighborhood. There were Jews and there were Catholics. I was told by my father, whose family originated in Germany, that German Jews were superior to Eastern Jews from Russia and Poland. Of course, my mother was born in Poland, so they always got along about things like that. But the other people that I met were mostly Catholic, Irish, Polish, Italian. In history class, we learned that most of America was a majority of people who called themselves Protestants. But they were a fractured bunch, Methodists, Episcopalians, Baptists, and so on. We read about them in history class, but in my immediate circles, most of us had never met a Protestant of any stripe, and Unitarians and Universalists were simply below the radar. High school changed that, and I widened my family concept by meeting people named Smith, Johansson, Marshall, many other waspish-sounding names. Some of my best friends were Protestants, although many of their parents were not very approving of their children's choices of me as a friend. But the circle was growing, and without knowing it, so was I. After completing high school, I enlisted in the Navy. The Korean War was going on, and I had no clue as to what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I was likely to be drafted at any moment. I decided that drowning was preferable to being blown to bits in a muddy foxhole, anchors away. Boot camp in the Navy was an extension of family. We were all in a fairly regimented rut, and commiseration with each other was about the only relief. I think in many ways that experience gave me the freedom to express and to listen to thoughts, hopes, and ideas that other young men had. And while my family was now much more diverse, I was eating, sleeping, and showering with some very different people than those I had known before. Black men, Hispanic, mostly Puerto Rican men, and men with very strange ways of talking. Deep Southern accents, New England twangs, the inflections of the hood, all among the languages. And there were many diverse ideas and cultural stereotypes to be overcome. One of my black buddies once had to explain to me that, and he was laughing, "Yeah, Bob, we get tan lines during the summer too." And at that time of life, I had a mop of hair down almost to my eyebrows. That is, once it grew in after the initial government-inflicted buzz haircut. There was a guy named Biggs in my company. He had never been out of rural Mississippi before. One day, he suddenly reached over to pull back the hair on my forehead. He had been brought up believing that Jewish people all had devil horns on their heads and was attempting to examine this hypothesis. I guess I was thankful that at least he was open to the possibility that what he had been taught might just be wrong. Soon after boot camp, Recruit Company 427's members all went their separate ways. None of us ever contacted each other, to my knowledge. But for 12 weeks, that was the family in which I lived and was a part. And in the various assignments over the next 4 years, new family bonds were established. And while each was in turn left, there was still a lifelong feeling of family for me. Same tight sense of family has accompanied me through my college and professional life. Although they varied and lasted for short times, memory keeps all of them in my mind and defines them as family. And they all had some common goals to help qualify them as such. As the years went on, I found myself in various situations, both socially and professionally, all of which widened my concept of family. During the 1950s and 60s, Hollywood produced a number of cheaply made black and white science fiction movies. A common theme was the threat to civilization from either, number one, mutant giant insects that had been inadvertently created by atomic bomb fallout, or two, invaders from space with superior minds and weapons. But there was a third: despotic humans who wanted to rule and or destroy the Earth. One of my favorites was a movie called The Day the Earth Stood Still. It had a slight twist in that the invading alien was really trying to save rather than to destroy civilization. But whether the aliens, cockroaches, or local mad scientists, whether meaning well or ill, the message was universal. All the warnings, all the warring nations of the world had to come together as family with the common goal to save humanity. In each case, the moral was that our earthly communities needed to put aside their differences, to team up to save the planet. From gigantic bugs, space invaders, or in the case of some of the plots, to save us from ourselves. In one movie, The Next Voice You Hear, the method to gain humanity's attention was for everything to simply stop temporarily. Nothing ran. Cars, boats, phones, TV, everything just simply stopped. The author was kind enough to exclude airplanes in flight, which was thankful. Every human on Earth was hearing the warnings in their own language. The viewing audience, however, only heard silence. Was it the voice of God? That was never made clear. But the message that humans heard and the demonstration of the short suspension of all human activity did the trick. Once we learned that the nations and tribes around the world realized cooperation was in everyone's interest, they all came together and the planet was saved. Hooray, kumbaya, family. The thing that separated Earth stood still and the next voice you hear from all the others was that the kindly alien was trying to save civilization from itself, not some outside force or genetic freak of nature. But in all cases, the moral was that there was a common interest in preserving the planet and, of course, those of us who inhabit it. The common threat forced us to embrace our humanity and recognize that while we had many differences, they paled into insignificance when compared with our common human desire to survive, just as did every family, dysfunctional maybe, but protective during times of peril. I don't believe we can afford to wait for either Godzilla or a benevolent alien to force us to save ourselves. The people of this green planet need to come together if we are to avoid extinction. If we don't allow me to recommend another movie to you, Dr. Strangelove. It won't be bug-eyed spacemen or, frankly, any other exterior or unnatural intervention. But as in most scenarios, rather the threat comes from the activities of our own species, the cruelty, greed, and warlike behavior of members of our human family. And I don't think we really need that benevolent space traveler to point out what we must do to avoid the apocalypse. We know what should be done. We are in a great time of peril right now. We can only survive if we recognize that we share this limited spaceship called Earth as a family. Do we need to wait until the threat becomes irreversible? In order for the family to survive, it must act as family. The threat is there. In the last few days, we've seen the very human right of certain families to exist be challenged by our government. We as a species have the power to destroy and the power to save. Let's not wait for the forces, whether they be native or alien, to threaten us. As that famous philosopher and comic strip Possum Pogo pronounced, we have met the enemy and he is us. How will we answer those who follow us when they ask, what did you do as part of this family?